Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I'd like to welcome you to my home. Today, I have a great guest with me. This is my friend Josh. We're going to discuss some topics of import. Well, how about, what do you think knowledge is? What is knowledge?
I don't know, as you go through time, you absorb stuff, you absorb bits of ideas or concepts or structured format stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. Word, just random word salad, but
so knowledge let's take an apple.
Obtained.
How can we know an apple? How do we know what an apple is?
Well, first, you probably would have to see it.
True. So a sensory input.
Yeah. And then to have any idea of what the apple actually is, you'd have to think to eat it, but that's not like an intrinsic thing that we all have, is to just put stuff into your mouth.
You could try. I've always wondered, with all the different variants of mushrooms or fruits, like, how did people go about figuring out what was good or not? And one of the things I've thought is that there might have been observers watching animals do it, you know, like seeing what animals scavenge. But then again, dogs can't have grapes, you know, so like there's a couple things that isn't cross species when it comes to food, like, so I'm sure we could have even seen. So that again, I loved how you said that, see, like, I feel like out of all the sensory input, one of the biggest things that affects us is what we see, or what we think we see. Like, so what are the attributes of an apple? Like,
well, its shape, I would say it's round.
Yeah.
Sometimes. We have an apple tree in my parents' backyard that is more of a nuisance than an apple tree. We've had good apples come out like a couple of years, and most of the apples that come out are like either eaten by bugs entirely or squirrels. Or if it's a good one and you try and eat it, it tastes like chalk. Mm. It's like sour chalk.
Like a Granny Smith.
I was just like, not even enjoyable. Oh. Not even enjoyable.
You ever had a crab apple?
Yes, there's some across the street. I don't really try to eat crab apples. I see the deers eat them all the time. Mm-hmm. But
it has a weight.
Well, you know, you get apple juice, which I think is great. To know about it, though, like, you wouldn't know about it unless somebody showed it to you, or you grew up obtaining knowledge from being like, here, take your apple, eat your apple.
Mm-hmm. Or apples are at the grocery store.
Yeah.
This is where you find apples.
Yeah. For most people, that's probably the only place they see an apple is at a grocery store.
Unless you have an apple tree like your family.
Or it's like a part of your food service program. And
yeah.
You know, it's on the plate, so it's something to eat.
Apples stress me out. Going about food service, apples are probably one of the most stressful food, like, because they're not time safe.
No.
When you're at home and you're just eating an apple, you don't notice how quickly it turns brown.
Yeah.
Like, and I remember the first time making an acid bath, you know, and fucking it up, and then coming back an hour later and you just cut like 40, 50 pounds of fruit and they're all just fucking brown. Yeah. You know, you're like, it's one of the most dangerous fruits to work with.
Jamie will like take an apple, take one bite out of it, and then like eat that bite and then set it down, and it will sit there for like hours and hours and hours. I'm like, oh man. But it's hard to eat it. It's like a kind of a commitment to try and eat a whole apple unless you're like really into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't eat as nearly as many vegetables or fruits as I think I should, but most of that's just due to convenience and eating while I'm standing up most of the time.
And where we used to work, you know, we worked at a college. Well, my friend still does, but working there, we had excellent food all the time. I thought at least there was always somebody making something good.
Yeah.
And the ability to our lunches, we were able to basically eat off of like what was left over, you know,
that or eat whatever you want.
Yeah. I really cared, or I'd make some crazy
it's
shit.
It does feel a little bit spoiled, but at the same time, like,
it's lucky.
You like, if you want to eat something, you're gonna like go and find what you want, not just what's there. Mm-hmm. At least that's how I look at it. Like, I don't just eat a pile of vegetables that I know is going to be bland, but it's probably really good for me. Mm-hmm. I find something that has like good flavor because I want to eat it.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes it pleasurable. Yeah,
there's a reward in it.
I don't like to say that I eat healthy. I prefer the term eating simply.
Okay.
And there's a relationship between my stress levels and between how I'm eating and how I'm taking care of myself.
For sure.
When I'm in a good space, you know, I'm going to be eating very well. When I'm in a good space and I have good routines and I'm safe and my life is safe, you know, I can have more room to stretch and to try to put myself through pressures such as eating a pile of bland vegetables.
Right.
One of the things that's really good for men to eat is broccoli. Broccoli contains a chemical. There's a chemical in it called SGC, which I think means sulfur glucosides. Don't quote me if you want. But SGC is in raw broccoli. As soon as you cook it, the SGC is locked into the cell walls of the broccoli. So to get the healing ability of the SGC, you have to consume it raw. Eating raw broccoli is one of the hardest things on humans. Our bodies don't absorb it very well. Broccoli is one of the most fibrous vegetables, and so when we cook it, we soften it, and it makes it easier to digest. We're performing digestion outside of our stomach, so it's easier to do it. You know, so eat a cup of raw broccoli.
I had a little bit last night.
Eat a cup.
Not a whole cup.
It's going to take you like 45 minutes.
Yeah, there's a lot of chewing.
And your jaw's going to be sore. And if you don't chew well, your stomach's going to hurt like a son of a bitch because you're going to get constipated and usually end up farting a while. You know? Like, but the SGC is incredibly good. SGC is a very potent antioxidant, and it's one of the few chemicals where I know this might be fad pseudoscience, but something I read that I liked, and I'm going to continue eating broccoli because I read it. You know, I could be silly for believing this, but they had some sort of scientific test where they took the SGC and dropped it on a cancerous tumor, and it made the tumor stop growing and even disappear. So it's like one of those things that they're looking into is for cancer treatments in lieu of chemotherapy and whatever other things that they're trying to do. Another thing that interests me about SGC and broccoli in particular is that in one of the top three killers of men in the United States is
prostate
cancer. Yeah. And so you have this thing going right by it physically. Sorry, I know it's a little gross.
No.
It's a little gross.
My dad had a procedure, and it's not like, I mean, what goes in must come out. You know?
So the logic, at least for me, says that if I try to eat some raw broccoli every once in a while, even though it's uncomfortable, there could be some benefits for it. You know? Like, and I can't do that when I'm tired. You can't make all those logical leaps of reasons on why I'm doing this I'm tired.
No, it's just whatever you can reach for most of the time. That's sad that it's like that for people. But
and then we buy it, too. And like, I've been struggling with snacks.
Yeah.
You know, I eat very simply. You know, what I do is I try to buy four to five units of vegetables. And I did really shitty this week, but this week I bought a yellow squash, because I'm only cooking for me and my son. So I bought a yellow squash, I bought a crown of broccoli, I bought a bag of Brussels sprouts, I bought an asparagus, and then I bought a bag of potatoes.
Those are all solid choices.
And they're easy, and I can steam them all. And just steam
and
salt.
A lot you can do with any of it, though.
Steam and salt. If it's the end of a long day and you can't think, I set my steamer up. It takes 5 minutes for my steamer to go. You know, cut the broccoli, wash the broccoli, put it in there, steam it real quick, a little bit of salt. It's edible. It's not raw, you know, or whatever vegetable, you know, or I'll broil it. Usually what I'm looking for is a quickness because it's end of the day. I'm not wanting to spend an hour cooking if I've been cooking all fucking day.
Right. It's a hard thing to do when you're already on your feet all day and then you get home and you're like,
okay.
Now I need to eat something.
Now I have to feed myself because I've been feeding others all day. It's a weird situation.
It's interesting that you went into the food direction anyways, because over the summer, my caloric intake was very, very, very low in comparison to like what I was eating before I went on to break. Because if I'm not working, I'm not burning nearly as many calories, and I just kind of bulge, and I don't feel great if I eat a lot. Like, it's not a good feeling if you know you're not going to burn the energy. So, like, my diet just, like, reduces down to, like, 1 to 2 meals a day, and they're not big meals. I'm just eating to pass through the next day. But when I get back to work, I'm, like, for one, super stressed, because
it's a high-pressure job.
My body's not, like, tuned to the level of demand.
And you are all feeding a shit ton of people.
Well, yes, it's a ton of people, a ton of stress, a ton of heat. And when you work in the heat like that, it's really difficult to work up a an appetite, at least for me.
I get sweaty.
Because I'm like, I will chug like 10 cups of water and have one bite of food in an 8-hour day. And that is the worst, the absolute worst thing I just instinctively do to myself when I get back
to work. You're ketogenic at that point.
And it's bad. Because it's like, I don't even want to eat. I'm smelling the food. I'm seeing the food. I'm nearly tasting it from smelling it all day. And by the time it's like time to go have a lunch break, like all I want to do is suck down water and go outside. Like I'm not even hungry. Mm-hmm. So then like I'll get home and I'm hungry.
And you got a 30. I personally do not believe that a 30-minute break is enough.
No.
For anybody. It's not.
Well, the second you punch the button, your break starts. You're like, you didn't even get to go sit down before your break. You're eating into your time.
Any job. Yeah. 30-minute break in a workday, not enough. I think an hour is a little bit more feasible. I have a lot of control over my life, so I usually take an hour and a half break between lunch and snack because I don't have anything to do. I can decide when and where I go.
Well,
I work by myself.
That's good.
You know, like, but yes, it's hard to eat when we get hot and sweaty. And people underestimate. I had a thermometer on a line once in a really poorly ventilated kitchen where in front of the stove, like 3 feet away from the stove where we would be standing, the ambient air temperature was at 115 degrees.
Yeah. That's fucked.
Those charred grills that you guys have are beasts.
Like, when I was in Rastel, I kid you not, like...
That char grill fucked me up.
I probably lost about 6 pounds in 2 weeks. Of just pure water weight. Like, because I'm not, like, super skinny, but I got a little pudge, but...
You look a lot.
Like, I could tell I was, side. Like, my t-shirt was, like, kind of getting a little uncomfortable at the end of summer, and then, like, back when I'm back at work, and I'm just, like, beads pouring down all day long... Finally, they get me a fucking build cap that has some ventilation instead of the closed skull cap that it kind of just, it's all dumb anyways, but like, I would prefer not to have to contain the heat and then know, like, your body's trying to cool itself down and it's not working because it's just like creating more moisture.
Oh yeah.
And then your face like starts to get hot and you know it's just generally a very uncomfortable situation and the only thing you can do is just power through it, you know.
So my kitchen is a very small box.
Yeah.
I have my stove with a vent above it, so I thankfully I have a vent.
Yeah.
I have no AC in my kitchen at all. Zero ventilation.
I imagine when that's on,
I have a window
that just starts cooking.
I have a little 1 by 1 foot window that I can open. My dishwasher isn't a chemical dishwasher, it's a heat dishwasher.
Oh, okay.
So it does not have a vent above it. Oof. So when it's on, it just billows steam.
Same story, different situation. I believe
it's so hot. And I've been trying to approach it in this way. One of the things that I've been working is cold. Have you ever heard cold training or cold pressure? You ever heard of Wim Hof?
Mm.
So Wim Hof is the Iceman. And so one of the things I started doing this year is cold showers, as deep as you can handle. If I had a cold stream outside, that's what I'd use. I'd go jump in it or a swimming pool. But the idea is that you have this thing called the vagus nerve or that goes down from the top of your skull to the bottom of your spinal cord. When you stimulate it with cold water, it stimulates the vagus nerve. And this nerve is responsible for the parasympathetic nervous response, which is what slows your heart rate, which is what calms your blood pressure. And so this cold water effect actually reduces blood pressure and can reduce stress, like anxiety, like acute anxiety, immediately. Like within 10 seconds. Like as soon as that nerve gets hit, you start to go, oh. Like at first you're like, fuck! And then you're like, oh, okay, I'm okay. So this sucks, but I'm okay.
To the freezer,
I'm okay.
To walk in and just be like, I need to cool down.
Yeah, I'm okay. And so there's also similar responses with heat. And so my personal theory on this is that exposing ourselves to temperature ranges that are outside of our comfort zones, because we live very comfortable lives. Most people are able to control the temperatures of their house, of their car. The only time that they are exposed to something outside of their controlled range is when they're, you know, walking outside or at work or something where it's not their home anymore, you know? And so, have you ever heard of Diogenes? Sorry, I'm digressing down like five different rabbit holes here.
No.
You ever heard of it? So Diogenes was considered a Cynic philosopher. So the term comes from him. So cynicism, what do you think cynicism means?
Well,
just right off the top of your head, definitions don't exist.
You're cynic, it's just like kind of... I don't know. You tell me.
So I would see cynicism as a big capital cynicism and a little C cynicism. So the little C cynicism is how we use it nowadays. And it's kind of like almost become a synonym for pessimism, a pessimist, like somebody who's very negative. Oh, that person's just cynical about life. So in Greece, there's a word, I can't remember, I think it's like cynaneros or something. Don't quote me. So that it starts with the C-Y-N, though, and it means dog. It's a derogatory term for a dog. So it's to call like a dog like a bitch or something, mm-hmm. like, oh, that dog's a piece of shit. Like, it's a bad negative term for a dog. And Diogenes was called the dog. Because he didn't work ever. All he owned to himself was a blanket. And so he would sleep outside all year round. He would move with the seasons. So he'd move north and south when it got hot and cold to try to hug the temperature ranges so it was a little bit more comfortable for him because he always slept outside. He would sleep on sidewalks. You know, so he would beg for everything he ever had. And so people called him the dog. And he would stick his nose into everything. And what was really funny about him is that he had this esteem as a mediator. So when people would be arguing, you know, like you have domestic disputes between husbands and wives and people are about to fight, people would go find Diogenes, like, hey, Diogenes, can you calm him down? And he'd come in and he had this amazing wit about him where he could talk to both people and he could make them see each other's side. So, like, I don't know where I got off on this tangent. So cynicism itself, Diogenes, temperature. Yep. So when reading these stories about this man who died 2,500 years ago, I started to think about these comfort levels, you know, and then I started looking into Wim Hof, who he's this guy who swam underneath like two football stadiums underneath an iceberg in just his underwear. Mm-hmm. He ran up I think it was like Mount Everest or something in just his underwear and a pair of shorts, like and like his boots.
You know, a mind over matter thing.
Yeah, and he says cold is my teacher, and then he's the first person I heard put out the cold shower routine, which is where you take your shower, hot bath, you know, you get real, you do what you got to do, and at the end, go as low as you can go, and sit in it as long as you can, and let it hit the back of your head. And you know, and at first you probably want to do 30 seconds, then you do 2 minutes, you know. And so looking at this, and I looked at my kitchen, and at first I was just like, oh my god, this sucks. You know, like my kitchen's so hot. You know, I'm just always, it's always very shitty in that kitchen. And then I just started thinking, well, I'm doing this cold shower thing, maybe I can try to just approach this as a challenge. You know, like, you know, I get home, even we didn't have the AC on this summer, all summer long, I'd get home, comfortable. Yeah. Everybody else, oh, it's so hot. Fuck summer. You know, everybody's complaining. Everybody's unhappy. And I come in with a smile.
Yeah.
You know, because your
body is like tuned to a different climate.
So I'm grateful to be home.
Yeah.
And so in a way, I'm grateful to that challenge. You know, like a little bit, you know, it did kill me.
Well, like... even just getting back into work from the summer off. So with the severe shortage of employees and supply chain issues and...
Oh, Cisco's been awful.
The massive amount of extra kids that are on campus, and these are the kids who...
Tell me, what are the numbers like? Because when I left, we were only feeding, like, what, 100 kids? Or if not less.
I mean, it may be a couple less. Hundred. It almost felt pitiful to even be there at that point. It was like, it's like you're just wasting your time for 100 kids. And mm-hmm. Yeah, the pay is good, but
you were subsidized. We were subsidized.
They were paying, we were subsidized.
We weren't making money anymore. We were pissing money out like a fire hose.
Yeah. But well, and these new freshman kids are kids who basically didn't have a senior year in high school. Mm-hmm. So they're all like the most unruly class of kids that we've had come into the school. So they eat fucking everything. They sneak kids in to get free food. Like, it is the wild fucking west over there right now. I'm trying to piece my thoughts together.
They used to overstuff bags there.
Well, yeah, that... but like everything that we put out is just gone, like fucking vultures. And there was a point where I did work where it wasn't like people were eating reasonably. They were like mindful of their intake. They're not just like grabbing everything they see to, you know. I mean, it's about food security at that point. And because
they have fridges in their dorms, and so they can kind of put food away and then heat it up. And yeah, they can eat off a meal for a while.
And but since we don't have as many employees as we need, and all the programs have been slashed. Like, everything that we were working towards with, like, great food, going over the top, having the fanciest of the fancy, and yeah, they're just high or college kids, but the company wanted to push, like, the programs to be more elaborate and grand, and due to COVID.
We did some cool stuff.
Due to COVID, almost all of the motions to get us to this higher level of food have been, like, backtracked, and now we're right back to where we started because we can't get our hands on the resources or the man hours, and the people that are there are being overworked, and, you know, 2 to 3 extra hours a day really adds up when you go home and it's already dinner time, and then you got to be asleep in 5 hours, and you've been at your work for 10. Like, it's the balance is gone at that point for me.
You need to have time for yourself.
And I would get home, take a shower, chug beer, try to watch YouTube for like 5 minutes, and then immediately fall asleep for like 2 or 3 hours just because my body's like shut. It's turning off. I can't even keep my eyes open. And it's pretty much been that for the past 3 weeks. And it's not bad, but I don't like pushing my body harder than it's like programmed to do.
A month from now, you know? It's going to be even more deteriorative.
Fuck. Yeah,
it's gonna deteriorate you. Fuck that word. It's gonna get you even more at the end of this month.
Like, I see it hitting our chefs right now. Like, they're there 12, 15, 16. Some of them are doing 7 day weeks, and their mood has gone from like fairly positive and fairly motivational to like absolute shit. And it like all trickles down. I think Cody's okay. I'm more worried about Brent and Brad at this point. They're just. Like, they let the anger thing out a lot, and I know why. It's because they're stressed, and, like, they're not rationally
thinking
through all of their, you know, emotions and things they need to do and say to people. So it all comes off a little short, and then, you know, that turns everybody else onto the same kind of mind state, and it's, like, contagious. So, like, one day I walk in, and everybody's fucking screaming and yelling at each other because they have all these crazy caterings, and I'm in my other space, like I'm in another room, and it's just like, I just feel that feeling all day where like, this doesn't feel right, because people generally aren't that mean or angry.
No, it's
not normally.
I think okay, let's try to tie in knowledge here. So we have a knowledge about a situation. And especially when it's been happening for a long time, people are not stupid. People are not idiots. You are feeling this tension. It's affecting you because we're empathetic beings.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and if you're in a bad spot, it's not like, you know, you can try. You know, I always tried to be a little bit of sunshine. I'd come in there and just do my happy Tuesday shit.
You gotta try, man.
But, like,
people think I'm crazy, and I'm just like, no, you just gotta smile and laugh, because this shit is not worth getting mad about.
So there's two levels of looking at how we come to a happening, you know, and we have a long-term happening that's deteriorating us. And what happens is that we react to happenings.
Right.
Happenings happen right now. Any thought about a future or a past event isn't happening right now. And so a lot of the times when I'm in a present moment, you know, sorry not to digress, but
it's all relevant, I'll
pull in
part of it.
You have this knowledge of all these past events, just these small little cuts that just are niching away.
By a million cuts.
and it's this environment. It's like a haunted house.
Yeah.
It's like a bad spirit in a haunted house. And I don't think it's an actual spirit, but I think groups of people carry, I always kind of think of it as this Uber conscience, this Übermensch, as the Germans would say, you know. And when you have a group of people, I always like to think that you can have a group of 100 very smart people, and the more smart people you put into a room, the IQ is going to steadily go down, you know, because when we group people together, we form this group consciousness sort of idea, you know. And so why I like working alone right now is because all I have to do is control my own consciousness, and it's the simplest and least stressful thing I've ever done in my life.
That's,
you know,
good.
But when you're working with a group of people and you have a big group of people, and you have this group consciousness that's sick, you know, and it's the environment that is burning people. And I see this situation a lot. I've worked.
It's not even so much the individual. It's like, what is the happening sort of thing you mentioned? Like so the chef, you know, gets an email mm-hmm. and says that corporate says we got to do blah 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 blah, and then the chef goes and talks to the employees about it because that's his job. But that's not who the chef is. That's not who they are as a whole. That's like mm-hmm. kind of what they had to become.
They're playing a role for the
group. Yeah, they're acting because that's what has to happen for everything to work right. But like, if we're all down and we're all sad or we're all angry and emotionally unstable, like it can go down real fast, and it's harder to get back up from mm-hmm. than to just stay up as opposed to down.
Yep. But have knowledge.
Yeah.
So I try to stay. I know it's cheesy, but I try not to stray away from the present. There's a lot of books about this. There's a lot of really gushy gurus. This is the message of everything. I even think it was Jesus's message. Even the Cynic philosopher Diogenes, I would say that he would even prescribe to the here-ness, you know, because this is where the happenings are happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and every happening is new and fresh and exciting. And we have this knowledge of past events, and it continues to affect us. But we can also have knowledge of that route, of how we are leaning on it. And so I try very hard to stay present-minded, and especially in crisis moments. You know, I'm a single father, and I have things that happen to me that aren't my choice that make it very difficult.
Right.
Like losing a house, or I had surgery 2 months ago. I had the same thing that Chris did. I had all my veins yanked out. And I was very nervous about this because I'm really bad with doctors. And
yeah.
I had this knowledge 4 months going into this, and I made myself miserable. And you know, I had been working on my present-mindedness, but in retrospect, again, I'm looking at this whole thing, and I saw how I didn't stay as present as I could. You know, because if you're present, you know what's going to happen in the future. Oh, this potential bad, horrible thing that I know is going to happen, you know, or this bad place that has been maiming me that I know I have to go to.
Yeah.
Just thinking about that can bring that tension in, you know? Like, so I try to focus on the happenings, you know? Like, and that's why I think I, even back then, I didn't really know what I was doing, but like a year ago, one of my favorite things I'd do where we worked is I'd come in, I'd try to say happy whatever day it was to every single person I saw as I came in. You know, I'd be like, happy Tuesday. And then we had this one dishwasher guy, I don't remember his name, I think his name was Ed.
Yeah.
And I'd go up to him, and I can't tell you how many fucking times I'd be like, happy Friday. Yeah, it was the happy Friday one that always gave me a kick, because we had this deja vu moment many times while working there. I'd go up to him in the dish pit, and I'd be like, happy Friday, Ed. He's like, my Friday's on Saturday. And I'm like, well, I said happy Thursday yesterday. You know, like, even in a shitstorm, it's surprising what you can do with your happenings
yeah.
in a present state. You know, and I'm in no way good at this. I fall all the fucking times to pressure and the stress of it all. And like, I've had several instances this week that I'm not proud of with my behavior and my actions. You know, I'm a hothead, you know? And thinking about these things makes my heart hurt because I don't feel good about them. But when I try to stay present, especially like staying present with the kid, you know, sitting down, picking stuff up with your child, you know, if that's what was happening, you know? Or being present with your YouTube video. You said it's 5 minutes, but it's a hyper alert, controlled moment where you are focused on what you want to be focusing on. And that's what makes it so valuable and feel so good. Right?
Yeah.
You know? Like, or I would say even a good shower when you get home. That's a very important 10-minute little section. You know? Not to beat a horse, but I like, one of my favorite words is meditation, and the practice of my meditation practice that I've been working on. And that is the epitome of presentness, you know? Like, you can let your mind wander. And I'm sure mine often does at first, especially, you know? But I like to meditate for about 30 minutes, usually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 15, 20 minutes into deep breathing, you know, you start to notice spaces in between the clouds of thoughts, all those presentes and those pasts. And all the potential futures, you know, like you start to notice spaces between those, and that's the ultimate presentness, you know, like is like, I think you mentioned it earlier when you're just sitting in your room and staring at a wall, you know, that's, it's very nice sometimes, you know, like it's a controlled act.
Yeah.
It's pure freedom.
Well, pure freedom. Part of like having meditation be like a very positive reinforcing thing that some people may not even know they're doing. Like if you become addicted to anything like media, TV,
cigarettes,
music, cigarettes, drugs, like
gambling, anger,
having that constant, like the happy drug, the serotonin, like when you get the serotonin release from, you know, scrolling, even.
It's awful. Responding. Responding's my bad one. I like to respond to people.
I find the more that you just like blindly consume, the less joy you find in your life, the less stability, because it's just always like you want to see more and learn more and absorb more and more and more, but
more knowledge.
You yourself, like,
would you say
you might just be in a room just consuming it? And
could you say knowledge is addictive in a way?
In a way, yeah.
Even gaining
knowledge. It can be dangerous. It can, like, I think you have to find a balance of like even if you love somebody so much that it like hurts when they're not around, but like you still know that you have to do that. You
have moments away from them.
You have to like break away from all of these things for even just a little bit to try and like center yourself and don't consume so blindly. Like
the Buddha said that our inner soul is a flickering flame. And that what we're really trying to do is to still the flame. Have you ever seen a fire in a completely still room with no airflow? Where,
the flame's always moving.
Mm-hmm. So
it needs air to live.
Yeah. The idea of peace is to still the flame. And that all of our desires and all the tugs, all these things that we consume, whether it's knowledge or food or chemical, those are tugs that pull our fire off of center. And the Buddha would say that the practice is try to stay, like just like you said, to stay centered. You know, when something really good happens, responding to it like, oh, this is the best thing ever, it leads to a feeling of, I want to keep this thing forever. And then that desire leads to struggle and strife, because when you lose it, all of a sudden something that made you feel good has become an old scar.
Yeah.
You know, and then when we have something horrible happen to us, you know, oh, this is the worst thing that is ever going to happen, leads to the exact same feeling on the inverse of, this awful feeling is going to stay here forever. And yet, when that awful feeling abates, it's pleasurable. So the Buddha would say that both the pleasure and the pain are the exact same entity.
Yeah.
It is the desire, it's the attachment to a good or a bad. And the judgment of this situation is good or bad. And so the still flame in the middle, when the Buddha would have a bad thing happen to him, okay. Something really good happens to him, okay.
Yeah. No, really.
You know, like,
when you're under a massive amount of stress constantly, like, yeah, weed is a super nice outlet. Like, mm-hmm. I used to smoke weed before I go to work every single day, and I could be fucking like hit by a train every single day, which is in a metaphorical way what happens, but I never got like attached to, you know, how much of a failure or an success it may have been. And yeah, I went through like physical pain and sometimes emotional pain because of the way people are, but the less that I grab onto in that moment,
and you just do it,
the better the outcome is. Like, people would be like, I don't know how you do that. And I'm like, it's because, like, I ignore everything.
I think that's beautiful.
I just ignore it.
I
don't take it to heart. I don't let the emotion control me. I just fucking ignore it.
That was a disattached work state. And I think that's beautiful. I think that's the goal in a lot of ways. So in Hinduism, in the Bhagavad Gita.
You feel a lot lighter when you're not, like, carrying stuff.
Yeah. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, have you ever heard, have you ever much attachment, or any, or not attachment, do you have any knowledge of Hinduism in?
I did read a little fair amount of stuff in Hindu, but not, like, probably nothing. You have a rough idea. To what you've read.
So, Bhagavan is the impersonal Godhead, which is the universe. So this table is Bhagavan. God, Bhagavan, the God, the actual God has no intention. it's the actual, it's material in a way. It's the impersonal. And so Bhagavan incarnates into Vishnu. Vishnu is the creative element of the universe. It's the intention, the forward, the cause and effect, the entropy, the constant motion towards something or the constant dissolving of something. And so Vishnu impregnates his wife Kali. Kali is that black demon-headed bitch with like the
skulls. Pretty sure I saw her at one skulls. Point. I've seen her.
As she's chewing skulls, she's like giving birth in a highly visual manner, mm-hmm. you know? Like, and so that's the divine mother. That's life, life and death, you know? And so Vishnu, the creative element, basically her and him and Kali make the universe. And then into the universe is the myriad of life. And then Vishnu incarnates into Rama and Krishna. And so Krishna is basically a Jesus of Hinduism.
Did you ever read that Be Here Now book?
Is that by Ram Dass?
I'm not sure.
I think I have it.
I have a copy somewhere, but it says like Be Here Now like 300 times on every page.
That's Ram Dass. I have it upstairs. I love him. He's a great guy.
I have that copy somewhere.
He's a beautiful spark of a man. But my point, though, just a brief little idea. So you have Krishna walking around among men at this time, and so it's basically the personality, the spiritual element, walking amongst men. Who we have a piece of Vishnu, we have a piece of Bhagavan in us because we're the every bit of life is the children of the universal element, right? But Krishna is a piece of the actual God without the human. Basically, and so Krishna's walking amongst men and he's giving advice, and one of the biggest pieces of advice that I got from the Bhagavad Gita was there's a term called fruitive action. So fruitive is leaning towards the idea of a fruit, which means our actions are like trees and our actions produce fruit, and so everything we do produces karma. We produce something. When we do something bad, we produce pain. When we do something good, we produce good. When we work, you know, like all these things, whatever. You know, not even what we get paid for. Those are all actions. And they produce fruits. And so there's this huge section where Krishna is talking to Arjuna, and he basically says, you know, the secret to life is to never be attached to fruit, the fruits of your actions. He said the point, you know, the essence of being spiritual is to go about your life and he basically said to give all of your actions to Krishna, which basically means I'm doing, like a real Hindu would be like, well, I'm doing this action for Krishna, you know, this isn't for me, you know, and they're ignoring the good or the bad, because even when something bad happens, I'm taking this bad, you know, I surrender to it and I'm giving it to Krishna, is basically the essence of this variant of Hinduism and Krishna consciousness. And so I really like how you said that, because what I see the heavy elements of this fruitive action, and I wasn't even aware. I wasn't really aware myself personally. I didn't really consider how I was treating the fruits of my actions. You know, I think a lot of people just produce fruit all willy-nilly, and
it's true.
How do you think people, like, I'm sure a lot of people are aware.
There's a lot of different types. Yeah. I have some friends who are like, they don't like to have stuff. Like they, you know, they've had a lot of different things, but for the most part, like, stuff is just something in the way of where they want to get. And then on the flip side of that, like, people who just have so much stuff, they don't even know where or what the stuff is.
Like hoarders.
And so this, I think, like, I'm like somewhere stuff. In the middle.
Yeah.
Like, I don't place value on, you know, if, like, you want a thing, like, you're gonna try and do what you can to obtain the thing, mm-hmm. but then, like, once you have the thing, like, what's its purpose, what is it there for, what does it mean, how does this, like, I think, like, if you're gonna have stuff, like, you need to have a reason to have it. Like, it's not, like, you gotta have shoes, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have to, like, you could go through life without shoes, but you kind of need them, and but if you're talking more about actions, like, setting your intent on like a specific outcome, or like just wanting to have a positive day or something mm-hmm. like that.
Walking into work and like
something as small as that.
If something bad happens to me at work today, then my day is going to be bad. That would be an attachment to a fruit in a way.
Yeah.
Beforehand. Like, I feel I do that sometimes, especially if I wake up on the bad road, you know? I'm like, ugh, I don't feel good. I'm going to have a shitty day now. Like, how do
or
I know
you
that?
Wake up on the wrong side of the bed. Yeah, it's hard to have, like, a set intention every day and then, like, you know, be solid with it. Sometimes things happen and you can't control it. Like, I was thinking about this. Like, I started chatting with Johnny last night, and he was like, I looked up to Johnny a lot, and I still do, because he was very knowledgeable. He just was kind of weird, and all the chefs mm-hmm. didn't really click with him, but I still value his knowledge and, you know, what he has to say about something. Like, I value it a lot, and it's really hard to find that kind of value with these new guys because I haven't seen them perform. I haven't seen the fruit. I haven't seen them do the right thing yet. Mm-hmm. But I don't get to say what that is. That's just what ends up happening. And it's difficult. But I was talking with Johnny. I was like, they want a business plan. They don't want the people. Mm-hmm. The people don't matter. The business plan is the only thing they're trying to do. The people are just there. They're just little vehicles for
all
this
they have
bigger
is the
plan.
Fruits, and they're not even paying attention to the actions that produce them.
Like, individuals have real needs, and like, if you're a business and you're trying to operate solely as a business, like, you're gonna fail if you're working with people and that's your bread and butter. Like,
we're in the service industry. We're in the hospitality industry, you know? Like,
it's sad because, yeah, you want the corporate wants those numbers. They will do anything for those numbers and literally stomp on anybody to get them, but it doesn't... It does... Like, it sucks to feel dehumanized. Mm-hmm. That's... And I was talking with Johnny about that, and it's just like... Because it just... The thought kind of, like, pieced together when I was talking with him, because I was like... Oh yeah, you're one of the only people that actually knew about what happened that's left. And he knows it better than I do because he was higher up the ladder. I'm just a cook, and I'm not in on most of what happened, so it's a little weird.
Yeah. I think you need to move ship, buddy.
That's you what might I think. Be right.
I think you both need to move ship.
If I get a good raise, I'll stick with it for a while, but I'm not. I don't want to keep being used like this.
You're capable. And there's a lot of shit out there, man. There's, like, I know that there's probably a lot of applications, especially with the unemployment thing, like you said.
Yeah.
Like, that makes sense. But still, it's a numbers game. And
it is.
You got a pretty good resume using color, like, that school, you know? Like, you got a pretty good fucking resume. That's powerful. Like,
I would like to move... If I move to like another city, which might be a thing, I'm not sure. I'm still in that like
where would you go?
The unborn phase where I don't even know what I want to do yet. I don't have a plan.
Well, you don't have.
I think like honestly, I could just look up whatever the city has for open food thing and kind of pick and choose from there and probably get pretty far. I don't like.
You can
the
apply
idea of fine dining. I
you can apply
like
to
bait.
Other places before you get there. Keep
this
that in
is
mind.
True.
You can apply to places while you're in a place. And you can have a job set up before you move. You don't have to struggle.
Yeah.
Keep that in mind. I met this really cool guy. His name was Pharaoh. He was an Egyptian man that I met when I was canvassing for a political campaign when I was 19 years old, when my son's mother was still pregnant with my son. She was about 3 months pregnant. I'm fresh out of high school, scared shitless, and canvassing for this campaign. And I meet this guy. He was a little bit older than me. I think he was like probably 28, you know, which is like basically my age now, you know? And I remember he just told me his life story, and it was just batshit crazy because he grew up in Egypt. He was one of 9 children. His dad was abusive, And so, like he got, I think there was, like, allegations of him being molested. And so he left home at the age of 9 and took care of himself on the streets of Egypt. And then when he was 14 years old, he started moving, and he, like, got himself through, like, the Mediterranean, and, like he basically just supported himself and was, like, he was a world citizen, and just went through Europe, you know, ended up in the UK, and then he ended up in America, a year before I met him. You know, but by the time I met him, he had an amazing accent, but he was very well-spoken, you know. He was one of the most flamboyantly gay men I've ever seen. Second to Dwayne. Fucking holy shit. But, no, and one of the things he told me, he's like, you can go anywhere you want in the world. He's like, the whole world is exactly like this. All you have to know that you can do is that you have to have a spot lined up. You have to have a place to live before you get there. He's like, you have to have a job lined up. So you can get the kind of work you're doing here anywhere in the world. He's like, if you have those things two lined up, you save up $2,000, you can go anywhere you want, anytime. Basically what he was telling me, you know? And he said it so simply, like, just have shit lined up, have a little bit of money, and you're there. Like, and he's like, except Africa. Africa is the only place that's not like that. He's like, Africa's fucked up. You know, but like, the way he said it was just really interesting, you know? Like, always just plan out your steps. Anything's possible. It's a lot, you know, like, I couldn't drag Odin. It's a little bit different with children.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I'm in this weird position where I plan on working for probably another 15 to 20 years until my son is able to support himself and then make a choice on how he wants to live his life. And then I'm out. Like, I have no intentions of working for the rest of my life. Like, I hope I have a trailer, some sort of way to support myself. I'm fucking out, dude.
Well, society's a joke as it is. It's not. It's not designed to be free. It really isn't. Like, it is its own prison. I always thought that having a cat was the only thing holding me back. And then she passed, and now it's just money. And I don't really want to just leave is the thing. Like, I want to make what's there good. And that's the hard part, is when, like, I have the intention of doing my best and wanting to have it work out. That is my intent, but
you also have the uncertainty.
It's also, there's uncertainty, it's family, there's a lot of reasons. Like, I want to make the right choice. That's pretty much it. Like, I'm just saving and trying to set up a path.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're very capable. Yeah. You gotta know that and be able to trust yourself and know that you are capable of making anything happen if you put your mind to it. You know? Like, you're very intelligent, you know? You have a lot of knowledge on your field. You could do this work anywhere. You know? Like, you know, just always have a little bit of that trust inside yourself that you're capable and you're competent to be able to do that kind of thing.
I'm not going to be a corporate shill. Like, yeah. I will never succumb to that. I'm there, but I'm not. Like, I don't want to be a chef at that company. Like, mm-hmm. You lose your soul. Seriously.
Or you sell it. All right. I would like to think about the apple again.
Okay.
So, I'm going to end on this little bit. That's one of my bits. I think I tried it with you once, but I hadn't developed it all the way. I didn't have a good package, a good wrapping, and now it has a really pretty bow. It's sparkly, you know?
I get where you're going.
So here's my apple bit on abstraction, you know? So with knowledge, I would say that we gain knowledge from our sense information. No matter what we get, even if we hear somebody talk to us, we have to hear symbols emitted to us through auditory ways that they're describing symbolically through language and idea that we get a percentage of. Like, I don't think anybody, unless they're very good at talking, can ever get all of their message completely across to somebody, because we're using this really weird way to communicate with these sound waves. And I don't trust language. I try to, you know, but so all knowledge comes to us from some sensory information, from seeing it, from hearing it, and then we fuck with it. We experiment with it, and we can mess with things in the real world, and we can also experiment with ideas. And so we take ideas into our head and say, I have an apple. You know, this apple is red, might be green, might have different shades. It has a certain weight, it has a circumference, it has a taste, flavor, profile to it. You know, all these things are things that I've sensed through my sense data. You know, these are direct observations, you know? And then somewhere in my mind, there's this strange leap, which I like to call abstraction, where my brain starts to piece together all these separate sense things. The redness of an apple on its own, is there anything that's just redness or just roundness or just appleness even? You know, so we take these things in, we take the weight, we take the red, we take, oh, I've seen this before, I have all this past experiences with it that were also sensory, and we make this leap where we say, oh, red, circular, round, this is apple, you know? And then there's further ways that we can abstractify. That's a pretty close-knit abstraction that I would trust, you know? However, one of the most abstract things that I can think of is mathematics, you know? And it's very helpful. And I wish Jamie was here, because I think me and her would have had a huge argument over this, you know? Like, but I think that math is incredibly useful. It's incredibly helpful. And we can move mountains. We're on Mars because of math. You know, like, I don't care what the flat earthers think, you know, like, we made it to the moon because of math. You know, math works.
Yeah, it's real.
Because we're describing things with a language that is real, like you said. Yet, when we take something like a simple notion, like 1 + 1 = 2, can't deny that, right? One and one equals two.
No, yeah.
But now let's bring apples back into this. I have two apples, right?
Okay.
I have a red apple and another red apple, but they're slightly different pigments. They're a little different, even visually, right? They have different circumferences. They have different weights, you know? I have two apples, right? Because of math. Yeah. But is there a separation between the 1 + 1 = 2 and me holding two apples being two apples? Which apple would be one apple if they weigh slightly different?
Ouch.
You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know if I have an answer for that.
And I think it began maybe with even chimpanzees do this, where we had a couple rocks and we decided what a unit is. So I find the mathematic one to be an abstract unit. And we use these units spectacularly well. Like, and it's like magic to me. I do think it's like black magic, the way we do things with math. Because
not
I don't,
to derail I, you, but have you gotten into cryptocurrencies at all?
A little bit. I don't know much about it.
That's right there.
Yeah.
That's right there.
Like, I understand the Bitcoin, the computer aspect, the blockchain, like, but.
Well, if you could put $1 in, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole too far, but if you put $1 in, and then you have your abstracted money, supercomputer money, whatever you call it, and you wait 10 years.
And it grows.
Well, like, it could turn to nothing, or it could grow, and it could exponentially grow, like. It could be way more than the $1 you started with, but really it only ever changes or moves based on if all the other people that are doing the same thing, like if everybody buys, the price will go high. If everybody sells, the price goes down. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a
middle ground,
a waxing and a waning of like that. It's all cyclical, but. Like, I mean, it's fascinating. It's sad that it's such a scam territory right now. Like, there's so much dumb shit going on in that space, but...
I think it's a good move.
It's interesting because the governments are just printing never-ending amounts of money. Mm-hmm. And...
But it's all abstraction.
It is all abstraction.
I don't think any of it has
But if you go, if you go to the length of, like, putting a certain amount of money into your bank account... And then
it can still move
and
your,
then save it.
It can still make you have a new house. You can turn this abstraction into a physical
but
body.
But if your society moves faster with like the inflation, then like that amount of money you have saved like dwindles in value. It doesn't increase in value. It's just like the purchasing power of a dollar is way less than it was 10 years ago.
Isn't that what happened in the Great Depression? Isn't that part of the reason why the money, it just lost its value, right? And that's what happened to Germany.
Yeah.
Where Germany's inflation, they just...
It's happened all over the planet, like over and over. Like,
so, yeah, that's interesting.
I know that's like not the knowledge things we're going to, but...
Absolutely.
It is like a unit of something that...
There are no closed doors.
Like, the value of it is whatever people make it. Yeah. It's not a set, like, you know, the token you put in the arcade machine.
Isn't it kind of spooky, though?
Yeah, it's a little spooky.
When you really look at that little distinction between the mathematical notion of 1 plus 1 equals 2 and holding two actual objects, there's a spooky space in between. Like, I feel like there's... And that's, like... I feel like it's, like, trying to hold a bar of wet soap is the effect of trying to analyze that space within yourself. It's, like, it's such a slippery idea to even consider. And the only thing I can even relate it to is the space in between thoughts when I meditate, and those moments of non-thought, of non-ado. Like, it's pretty weird. It's one of my investigations. We'll have a year from now, and we'll have another one. See, I gave it a really sparkly bow, didn't I? Like, I have these bits. I'm proud of them. Hey, I really appreciate you for coming.
Yeah,
I think we're pretty high on time, and I think that's perfect. I think that's seconds. I haven't really figured out how to do it yet. But just to end, what's some advice you would give to yourself 5 years from now? Or what's some advice you'd give to yourself 5 years ago? You can pick either one.
That's tough. 5 years ago, probably be careful who you trust. Five years from now.
That's weird, right?
It'd probably be the same. Probably.
Just be safe.
I got trust, not trust issues, but I think trust is...
I think it's a
very complex thing.
I think it's a symptom of the uber consciousness. Because as a country, even the United States, even though we're loosely attached... And a lot of the times we're never going to speak to 99.99999% of our country we're never going to interact with. You know? I think most people ever have like 200 friends, I think is a number I've heard put out. Like 200 close attachments in life. And we have billions, right? I don't even know where I was going with this. I just lost my train of thought. Fuck. That sucks.
Trust. No, I don't know.
I think that even as countries, we have these very abstract uber consciousnesses. And I think a lot of these trust issues are symptoms of very sick, big group consciousnesses. And as a world, even, there could be layers to this onion. And on the outer layer, the uber minch of the world, the world's group consciousness, I have very sad feelings, you know, about that. And I have trepidations about our future. But I do know that as pieces of this consciousness, we have the ability to affect one another. And we can be loving, and we can be kind, and we can try to be little bits of sunshine. We can take care of ourselves. And by taking care of ourselves and by loving ourselves first, like when we love ourselves first, it makes it easier to give love to others. And then when other people see it, it's contagious. And it spreads like a virus. And I know that's very optimistic, but... That's one of the things I believe. You know, it's part of the reason I try to make this show. You know, like, connections of just giving compassion and being curious about other people and just being able to sit with another person presently, you'd be surprised how much just, like, you've helped me. So many times in the past, sitting out on that road smoking cigarettes when I was really fucked up in the head over something, you have no idea how many times you helped me by just listening, talking to me. Some of those valuable moments in my life. And I've had many moments of that, like with many other people.
Yeah.
And it has such a profound effect, you know? Like, so I know life gets really tough, but I like to try to think that it might just be a symptom of something bigger and that I can try to make that a little bit better by treating it, you know?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
Thank you for coming here today, man.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, hopefully we can do this again sometime. Nice. Hi, everyone. Like to thank you for listening. This is the end of the show. I had a lot of fun doing this interview. Josh is a very close friend of mine. He's an amazing dude, very compassionate heart, and he has always had my back and an ear. And he reminds me of how important it is to have your friends' backs and to have an ear for them. So if you have somebody out there who's struggling, remember to go give them a little bit of love and to give them an ear. You know, just thank you. I'm grateful. Have a wonderful week.